Shalom, and thank you for listening at BethEmmanuel.org. 26 Answers to 26 Reasons is a live recording of a midweek class conducted by Pastor Lancaster in 2009 to answer common anti-missionary objections to the gospel. The class purchased and used Asher Norman's book, 26 Reasons Why Jews Don't Believe in Jesus, as a textbook for discussion. This book is available from Feldheim Publishers, copyright 2007. You can join the class by listening along as we defend Messianic Judaism and the claims of the New Testament. To support Beth Emmanuel in our continued work, please click on the Donate tab at BethEmmanuel.org.
My friends, tonight we have trouble. Now, up until now, this has been fairly easy, wouldn't you say? We've been just kind of going through and enjoying going through Asher Norman's book, pointing out, well, that's not a really substantive objection. But tonight, there are some substantive objections. And so, I don't know how we'll, if we'll get through the whole lesson tonight or not, because we might have to slow down to talk about this. On the other hand, we might just... It might behoove us to just blow through it really fast and not pay so much attention. We'll see what happens. It's in God's hands, huh? One nice thing about the Bible is that you can always, at any point, you can just say, I didn't write it. It's God's book. Here's our premise for reason number 8. And this is reason number 8 why Jews don't believe in Jesus, which I said should be titled 26 Reasons Why Jews Shouldn't Believe in Jesus, is more the sense of the book, more the intent of the book. So these are not necessarily reasons why Jews don't believe in Jesus. Generally, Jews don't believe in Jesus because they're Jewish, and Jewish people don't believe in Jesus, and that's what it means to be Jewish for most of the world. Now that Jewish identity has been so reduced after the Enlightenment, there's this one remaining tenet of what it means to be Jewish. You don't believe in Jesus. So, Asher Norman's book, in a sense, is an attempt to bring some substance to that aspect of Jewish identity. Anyway, we digress. Reason number 8. Reason number 8 why Jews don't believe in Jesus is that Jesus failed to fulfill any of 6 authentic messianic criteria. What does that mean? It means that there are 6 things that the Messiah has to be or do in order to be the Messiah. And Jesus didn't do these 6 things, or was not these 6 things. And so it says Jesus did not qualify as the Jewish Messiah, Ben David, the Davidic Messiah, for the simple reason that he did not fulfill any of these criteria. And then Asher Norman goes on to explain what it means to be Mashiach in the first place. A Mashiach is an anointed one. He points out any king of Israel that's anointed with oil, you know, he's anointed with oil as a king. So every king of Israel is Mashiach. So every king of Israel is a Messiah. David's a Messiah, Solomon's a Messiah, King Saul is a Messiah because he's an anointed one. Every priest is an anointed one because every high priest is anointed with oil. So every high priest, you could say, is a Mashiach. But to be the Mashiach, the Messiah son of David, is to be this predicted Davidic king that will accomplish these 6 things. So let's take a look. What are they? Number 1, it says, genealogy. He must be a son of David through Solomon. If he's not a son of David through Solomon, he doesn't even qualify. He's not even in the running. He might be a wonderful person that accomplishes all the other things that Messiah is supposed to accomplish. But if he's not a son of David, then he's not the Davidic Messiah. Fair? Okay. Number 2, he must be anointed as king of Israel. This also seems fair and obvious, since that's what Mashiach means, the anointed one, anointed as king of Israel. Number 3, he must return the Jewish people to Israel. And we'll look at a few prophecies if we have time that say so, but suffice to say, that is the primary job of Messiah in the prophets of the Old Testament, is to gather in the exiles of Israel back to the land of Israel. Number four, he must rebuild the temple in Jerusalem. Number five, he must bring peace to the world and end all war. And number six, he must bring knowledge of God to the whole world. Okay, and so we'll look at the scriptures as we have time. But I want to go back to his premise. So he says, these are the things that define Messiah, and since Yeshua did not do these things, he's not the Messiah. And he points out that these criteria are empirically verifiable. And this is a very interesting thing, and we need to establish this. So I'm going to read to you a little bit of what he wrote here. He says, faith is irrelevant to the Jewish concept of the Messiah ben David, because an individual either fulfills these prophetic criteria or he doesn't. Christianity requires faith that Jesus is the Messiah precisely because he did not fulfill the Jewish messianic criteria. Now that is a correct statement. That is absolutely true. We are called believers. Why are we called believers? We're called believers because we believe that this man is the Messiah without proof. Now, if I was part of a group, imagine if I formed a special group that believed that Barack Obama is the president of the United States. And that was our, you know, that was our affiliation. And I would say to people, you believe Barack Obama is the president, don't you? Because if you're not, we're going to cut you off and throw you out of here. You know, there's probably not going to be too much conflict with people because that's something that's empirically provable right now, that he is the president of the United States. Yes, so it doesn't require any faith. It doesn't require faith. Whereas the fact that Yeshua of Nazareth is the Messiah of Israel ahead of the time when he has actually accomplished what the prophets say the Messiah of Israel is going to accomplish, that is a leap of faith. This is not a bad thing. Asher Norman, he says, Christianity's concept of faith in Jesus is therefore a substitute for this defect, the defect being that Jesus hasn't accomplished these things yet. We say, well, you just got to believe because you can't prove it. But that's exactly what faith is. That's exactly what it means to be a believer. Now, I can liken this back to my Barack Obama analogy. Suppose that before, when it was still, it still looked like Hillary Clinton would be the choice for the Democratic nominee, if I had started a little group of believers that Barack Obama will be the next president, you know, and we became the Barack Obama supporting team, and then he got in, you know, that's pretty good. You know, we maybe could have done some campaigning for him and achieved some positions in the on his cabinet or something like that. I don't know. So the idea is, from the apostolic perspective, that the really exciting thing about the gospel is that we have the goods on who the Messiah is prior to the Messianic era. So you have to understand that, because if you understand that, then the rest of the lesson is not so problematic. Understand that when Messiah comes, everyone's going to see it, everyone's going to know it, and it's not going to be a big, you know, it's not going to be like a big deal. You have faith in Messiah? Well, yeah, he's here. Let's press on here. Oh, he wanted us to read a little bit of Maimonides. And this is a great passage of Maimonides. So I'll read it to you. This is from Maimonides' treatise on the laws of the kings. It's an exposition on the laws that pertain to kings of Israel. And so this is a passage about Messiah. Very famous passage. He says, "We may assume that an individual is the Messiah if he fulfills the following conditions. He must be a ruler from the house of David. He must be immersed in the Torah and its commandments like David, his ancestor." This is from Deuteronomy 17. He must follow both the written and the oral Torah, lead all Jews back to the Torah, strengthen the observance of its laws, and fight God's battles. If someone comes along, he says, if one fulfills these conditions, then we may assume that he is the Messiah. Then we may assume that he is the Messiah. But we don't know for sure yet. If he does this successfully and then rebuilds the temple on its original site and gathers all the dispersed Jews, and gathers all Israel into the land, all the Jewish people into the land, then we may be certain that he is the Messiah. He will then perfect the entire world and bring all men to serve God in unity. It is true that the prophet predicted the wolf will live with the sheep and the leopard will lie down with the kid. This, however, is merely an allegory, meaning that the Jewish people will live safely even with the wicked nations who are likened to wolves and leopards. So Maimonides is basically saying, if somebody accomplishes these criteria, he doesn't have to do anything supernatural beyond this, beyond accomplishing these criteria. World peace, rebuilds the temple, gathers in all of Israel, fights the wars of the Lord, strengthens people's observance to Torah. In other words, that's Teshuvah, brings returning them to God's laws. Son of David, that's all. If someone was to hit all of those, then that person should be considered the Messiah. Yes?
Is that why in the end times even the elect could be deceived of the Antichrist? Because he'll look like he fulfilled all those things?
No. It's the idea that the elect will be deceived because this Jewish Messiah will come and he'll do all these things and then he'll rebuild the temple and all of that sort of thing. And then they'll be deceived. And then the real Messiah will come. But that's not really, that wouldn't even be playing fair. If God sends us a guy who, fulfills all the criteria of Messiah, and then says, fooled ya. Wrong, that's the wrong guy. That's not even fair. If we had time to study the teachings on the false Messiah, to learn about false Messiah, there are some things that we can identify him by. He also has criteria he must fulfill to be false Messiah. And this is very much connected with Hanukkah, this idea of false Messiah. Because a false Messiah is modeled after Antiochus Epiphanes. So false Messiah, for example, must set up an abomination that causes desolation in the sanctuary. He must exalt himself as the Most High God to be worshipped. He's called the Lawless One. So he does away with Torah, so to speak. These are some of the biblical criteria of the Antichrist, or false Messiah. Okay, so let's get started on these criteria. The first one is the hard one. The rest are not so difficult. The first one is really the hard one. It's the genealogy. So Asher Norman says, regarding the genealogy of Messiah, we know this, and we know this from the scriptures. And we have the texts, so we can look them up. It might be useful to do so. Let's go to that. 2 Samuel chapter 7, one of the most critical messianic prophecies in the Bible. 2 Samuel 7. So Asher Norman says, okay, Messiah number one must be Jewish. How do we know that? How do we know he must be Jewish? Yeah, but let's just go with Jewish for now. Suppose David had a non-Jewish kid. it's possible. Isn't it? He could have. How do we know he has to be Jewish? There is a text. Does anyone know it? It's Deuteronomy. It's not 18, but 17. The Laws of the Kings says, when you appoint a king, you shall surely appoint a king from among your brethren, no foreigner. So to be a king of Israel, you have to be Jewish. Huh? Okay. So that's Deuteronomy 17, yes. He must be from Judah. How do we know he must be from Judah? No, that one's not. That one is back in. That's a prophecy from Genesis, the end of Genesis, when Jacob is blessing his sons. I think it's 48. Jacob is blessing his sons, and he says the staff, the ruler's staff, will not depart from Judah until Shiloh comes, which is universally, in all of the classic rabbinic commentaries, understood as a prophecy of Messiah. Now, how do we know he must be from David? That we learn here in 2 Samuel 7. When your days are complete, and you lie down with your fathers, I will raise up your descendant, your seed, after you. Now this word descendant, seed, refers to children. So it's going to refer in the immediate sense to his very next son, his heir, Solomon. But as you'll see, it also has a messianic aspect, speaking of a future heir. Your seed after you, who will come forth from you, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name. This is what Solomon did. But it also applies to Messiah, who must also build the temple. I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. This is how we know it's not Solomon alone that's being spoken of. Solomon doesn't fulfill the forever part of this prophecy, the throne of his kingdom. Once this king takes his throne, it must endure forever. I will be a father to him, and he will be a son to me. This is where we get the messianic title, Son of God, in the first place, is from this passage. When he commits iniquity, I will correct him with the rod of men and the strokes of the sons of men. This is also referring again to Solomon and Messiah, right? Solomon does commit iniquity, and he loses 10 of the 12 tribes. Messiah will not commit iniquity, and he will bring the tribes back. But my loving kindness shall not depart from him, as I took it away from Saul, whom I removed before you. Your house and your kingdom shall endure before me forever. Your throne shall be established forever. All right, that's how we know that the Messiah must come from the house of David. Then, another one, he must be from Solomon. I never thought about that before. That was a new thought to me, that he must be from Solomon. 1 Chronicles 22 is a parallel passage to the one we just read. And he would have us start in verse 9. 1 Chronicles 22, verse 9. Behold, a son will be born to you, who shall be a man of rest, menucha, a man of rest. And I will give him rest from all his enemies on every side. For his name shall be Solomon, Shlomo, peace. And I will give peace and quiet to Israel in his days. He shall build a house for my name, and he shall be my son. And I will be his father, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom over Israel forever. So you see, it's a parallel text. But based upon this text, Asher Norman says, it's got to be through Solomon. If the throne is going to be established forever through this Davidic son, it can't come from another son of David. It has to come only through Solomon. Why is this important? Why is this troublesome? Genealogy. Yeah, genealogy in the Gospel of Luke does not come through Solomon, right?
Matthew does,
thanks. Yes, so we have two different genealogies. And this is the problem. This is our big problem. It's not a new problem. It's an old problem. But there are two different genealogies. One is in Matthew, and one is in Luke. And they're very different. One of them is 15 generations longer than the other. They're completely different lines. They both start with David, but then they follow completely different lines. Matthew's genealogy has a few inherent problems. It skips a few generations. If you compare it against Chronicles, it skips several generations, in fact. Some would say it's Matthew's in perhaps attempting to contrive it so he can do that 15 generations or 14 generations, 14 generations, 14 generations. It's probably the case, but we could study the genealogies and the genealogy discrepancies and problems. We could do that for weeks, really. It's, yes?
Could you just describe that 14 thing for just
for
being
quite impressive? Oh, sure. Oh, check it out. Matthew chapter 1. Matthew is making all sorts of cool messianic allusions when he says in Matthew 1:17, after he sums up his genealogy, "So all the generations from Abraham to David are 14 generations, from David to the deportation to Babylon, 14 generations, and from the deportation to Babylon to the Messiah, 14 generations." So three sets of 14 generations is how he's constructed his genealogy. And he has to leave some out in order to get these three sets of 14. Why is it so important to him? There's a couple things. One is there's a tradition that's reported in the Midrash Rabbah that Abraham is likened unto the new moon. And then 14 generations later, the 15th generation, the full moon comes, King Solomon. 14 generations later, the moon disappears. You know, so you're following a lunar cycle. Zedekiah, the last king of the throne of David. 14 generations later, then, we have come to the full moon again. And so Matthew is trying to show us this cool, like, waxing, waning thing. Also, the number 14 is the gematria for the name David. Dalet is the word, the letter Dalet, like a D, is a 4. The V, or Vav, is a 6. And another Dalet is a 4. So Dalet plus Vav plus Dalet, 4 plus 6 plus 4, is 14. So 14 is the number of David. And so Matthew's playing with these ideas. Now Rabbi Lichtenstein, though, says, wait a second. Yes, Matthew's playing with these ideas, but Matthew's not just messing with us. Instead, he points out that the generations that Matthew skips in these genealogies are not full generations. They are kings that died young. And so they didn't live a full term. We don't have time to go through this, and I certainly didn't review the material before the class. But I would have you know that there is a substantive answer for the construction of Matthew's genealogy. And maybe if some of you probably were taking Lathan's class when he was taking you through the Lichtenstein, the early chapters of Lichtenstein. Was anyone doing that? No one here? Okay. Because he spent a long time on sorting that stuff out. All right, so we already mentioned that Luke's genealogy does not come through Solomon. Did everybody know there's two different genealogies and that there's such a conflict between them? You did not know that. Okay, good. So this is a real problem. The answer the early church gave was that, well, this is easily explained. He has two parents. You know, one genealogy belongs to Mary, and one genealogy belongs to Joseph. And the majority opinion is that Matthew's belongs to Joseph, and Luke's belongs to Mary. There is a problem with this, though. Luke 3:23 says, "When he began his ministry, Jesus himself was about 30 years of age, being, as was supposed, the son of Joseph, the son of Eli, the son of Matat, the son of Levi, the son of Melchi, the son of Yanni, the son of Joseph." Okay. So it doesn't, you heard the problem. It doesn't say Miriam at all. It presents itself in a very straightforward manner as a genealogy of Joseph, as does the genealogy in Matthew. I would think if one of these belonged to Miriam, it would be the Matthew one, because the Matthew one includes other women. Sometimes when you are studying Talmud, you come to the end of a long argument where you've had two different people arguing, you know, there are several different opinions being waged, a battle, and ordinarily we'll come to a resolution where somebody says, there's no difficulty here. What he was referring to is this, and what he was referring to is that, and then you have a reconciliation. But sometimes you reach a point where it says, this is a difficulty. And then it moves on to the next topic. Right. And so I'm not sure if we accept one of these belongs to Mary, one of these belongs to Joseph, then there's no difficulty here. It would make sense if it then concluded with, and Mary was the mother of. Now, another reason we'd like it to conclude with, and Mary was the mother of, is the virgin birth. And this problem with the genealogies is not so much of a problem as the virgin birth itself. The virgin birth is an even greater difficulty for establishing the Davidic descent of Messiah. Because the virgin birth, both the genealogies are irrelevant. You know, the genealogies of Joseph, who cares about the genealogies of Joseph? It becomes irrelevant. But isn't it interesting then that we have the virgin birth is only reported in two gospels, 2 out of 4. You know that? Only 2 out of 4 gospels even tell us about the virgin birth. But what 2 are those? Matthew and Luke, the same 2 that tell us the genealogies. So apparently, in the mind of Matthew and in the mind of Luke, the virgin birth did not make the genealogies irrelevant in any sense. Isn't that intriguing? This is a good point. So I've taught this before that, by marriage, a woman assumes the tribal identity of her husband. Right. So it doesn't matter what tribe she's from. She's married to Joseph, therefore she is a Davidic, she's a daughter of David, and legally the child is then, therefore, Davidic. Well, we don't know with Mary. We don't know with Mary, unless one of these genealogies is hers, but we don't know that. We can assume that, but it's something that we don't know. But that seems to disqualify the entire genealogy then. It's a big problem. This is a problem for us. Why? Because it's important that we have a son of David here.
But isn't Samuel was adopted by Eli, right? And so therefore, even though he wasn't of the tribe of Levi, he was able to serve as a Levite because he was adopted, right?
Yes.
So if Joseph adopts him, and Joseph is from the line of David.
Except there's a text in 1 Chronicles which tells us that Samuel is a Levite. That his father, Elkanah, was a Levite. So even though in 1 Samuel it says he's an Ephraimite, in Chronicles it says he is a Levite. And how is this to be explained? Well, the Levites lived in all the tribal territories. And so he could easily be a Levite living in Ephraim, referred to as an Ephraimite geographically, but being a Levite.
And
now So here's what Asher Norman says regarding this. He says, since Jesus allegedly had no human father, he had no tribal affiliation. Under Jewish law, tribal affiliation is through the birth father only. And then he cites Numbers chapter 1, verses 18 through 44, and Leviticus 24:10. Maybe we should look those up. Numbers chapter 1. They assembled all the congregation together on the first of the second month, and they registered by ancestry in their families by their fathers' households, according to the number of names from 20 years old and upward, head by head. But he said, so that's what he used as a proof that under Jewish law, tribal affiliation is through the birth father only. This would be a halakhic question. And I don't exactly know the answer or how you would fix such a halakha. there's just the sages have never really considered the halakha of a virgin birth. Virgin birth problem is not the problem we're having with the virgin birth is not that there is a virgin birth or anything like that. The problem we're having with the virgin birth is the tribal identification of the child that's born of a virgin birth. All right. Now here's what I've often wrestled with this in my head, because this does seem to be a problem. But the most interesting thing about it to me is that it wasn't a problem for Matthew or for Luke. That both of them saw this as not a problem whatsoever. So, well, Matthew and Luke are the ones who report it. They're the ones who report the virgin birth, and they're the only ones who report genealogies. And so they saw this as no difficulty whatsoever. So they're seeing something that I'm not seeing. All right, let me read you a little bit more of this on the adoption question. So here's what Asher Norman says regarding the adoption. It says, there's no indication in the Gospels that Joseph ever adopted Jesus under Jewish law, although under Jewish law, certain family and tribal affiliations must be through the birth father and cannot be claimed by adoption. For example, if a Jewish priest, a Kohen, has a male child, he has the status of priest by birthright. However, if he adopts a child whose birth father was not a Kohen, the child does not have the status of a priest like his adoptive father. Since Joseph was not Jesus' birth father, there is no evidence in the Gospels that Jesus was from the house of David, which cannot be conferred through adoption under Jewish law. This eliminates Jesus from messianic consideration. I really don't know how to answer that, is what I'm saying. So the virgin birth presents a difficulty. It does present a difficulty, but it was not a difficulty for Matthew, and it was not a difficulty for Luke, the only two guys in the Bible to tell us about the virgin birth in the first place. Yes, no, that's absolutely correct. There's several statements throughout Jewish literature that talk about David's suspect paternity. Yes, so David's paternity in the Midrash is suspect, and that's why Jesse doesn't summon him from the field when Samuel says, bring your sons before me, because Jesse didn't consider him his son. And so then when it says in the Psalms, this is the stone the builders rejected, it has become the chief cornerstone. The builders are referred to as the Davidic family, or the family of Jesse. The stone is, this is all in the Midrash, the stone that's rejected is David, who is rejected because of his suspect paternity. But it all turned out good in the end, and David's paternity was actually legitimate through an amazing story. Yeah. So, no, there is comfort in that there's definitely precedent in this. We've seen this before, and Rabbi Lichtenstein points this out in his commentary on Matthew. He points out that it says right in the Talmud that the house of David had lizards hanging from its back. It's an idiom like we would say skeletons in the closet. You know, the house of David had lots of skeletons in the closet. We're not going to resolve this virgin birth issue. I just want you to know the virgin birth, this is an issue. This is a difficulty. This really is a difficult, and there's no quick, easy answer to this. It's for this reason that the sect of the Jewish believers called the Evyonim rejected the virgin birth. Just said, no, his paternity is Joseph. As Asher Norman points out, this is important because of these six criteria, this is the only one that we have a shot at right now. You know, is to say, yes, he is a legitimate son of David. Now, the house of Joseph is certainly Davidic. I'm happy with the solution that I suggested, that this is actually some sort of miraculously is Joseph's through some sort of miraculous conception. I do know this, and Asher Norman points this out. This has been a problem for a long time. The brothers of our master, like James, you know, these guys had no, there's no question that they're Davidic. There's no question. In fact, the grandsons of Jude, who wrote the book of Jude, ended up being arrested by the Roman government when they were hunting down the sons of David under the Emperor Domitian. because they're Davidic, and it could be demonstrated that this was a Davidic family. So, but I want to read to you a little bit of stuff that you've never heard before. This is Julius Africanus. Julius Africanus is a 2nd century Gentile Christian born in the land of Israel, who apparently must have been Egyptian or something like that, with the name Africanus. Travels around, he becomes a traveling preacher and a historian sort of guy. Anyway, in the land of Israel, apparently, he had contact with some people called the Despocini. Despocini means the Lord's people. It's the family of the master. So he had contact with the descendants of the family of Yeshua. This would be his brothers, his cousins. So I want to read to you a little bit about what he says about the Despocini. Okay, first of all, he gives us a really long, convoluted explanation of how the two genealogies, the one in Matthew and the one in Luke, actually work together, because these two families, the one in Matthew and the one in Luke, are intermarried by means of levirate marriages. I've tried to read it and figure it out before. I would really have to chart it out. Have you ever heard the song, "I'm My Own Grandpa"?
Yeah.
It's about like that. But then he tells us where he gets this crazy idea. And this is very interesting. He says, he talks about the rise of Herod the Great, and talks about him being an Edomian, an Edomite, and he says, "As up to that time, the genealogies of the Hebrews have been registered in the public archives, and those, too, which were traced back to the proselytes. For, as example, to Achor the Ammonite, and Ruth the Moabitess, and those who left Egypt along with the Israelites and intermarried with them." So he's saying there were genealogies going all the way back. Herod, knowing that the lineage of the Israelites contributed nothing to him, and goaded by the consciousness of his ignoble birth, that he is Edomite, burned the registers of the families. This he did, thinking that he would appear to be of noble birth if no one else could trace back his descent by public register to the patriarchs or proselytes and to that mixed race, the mixed multitude. A few, however, of the studious, having private records of their own, either by remembering the names or by getting at them in some other way from the archives, pride themselves in preserving the memory of their noble descent. And among these happen to be those already mentioned, called Despocini, on account of their connection with the family of the Savior. And these, coming from Nazareth and Kokhba, just as an aside, when I read this passage, I realized these people, the brothers and master, were living we know they were in Nazareth, but what is Kokhba? What is Kokhba? It means star.
Yeah.
That's star. So you have these messianic prophecies of a branch will spring out of the Netzer. A branch will spring out of the stump of Jesse, right? So they named their village Nazareth. A star will rise out of Jacob. They named their village Kokhba. So I asked my brother, I said, "Do you know where is there any villages named Kokhba near Nazareth?" So he looks it up and he says, "Yep. Yeah, I actually went there. It was great. It's an Arab village now, but yeah, the Arab village preserves the name, even preserves the name in Arabic, an Arabic form of star. And as you drive into the village, there's this big metal star very cool. A village that was probably pioneered by a Davidic family. Anyway, these coming from Nazareth and Kokhba, Judean villages, to other parts of the country, set forth the above-named genealogy as accurately as possible from the Book of Days. Whether then the case stand thus or not, no one could discover a more obvious explanation, according to my own opinion, and that of any sound judge. And let this suffice us for the matter. Although it is not supported by testimony, because we have nothing more satisfactory or true to allege upon it. The Gospel, however, in any case, states the truth." And now he gives us just a little bit more about these two genealogies. Matan, descended from Solomon, begat Jacob. Matan dying, Melchi descended from Natan, that's the other genealogy, begot Heli by the same wife. Yeah? Therefore, Heli and Jacob, from these two different genealogies, are uterine brothers. So they're brothers. Heli, dying childless, even though they're from two different families, they're stepbrothers, you could say. Heli, dying childless, Jacob raised up seed to him as a leveret and begat Joseph, his own son by nature, but the son of Heli by law.
Whoa.
Isn't that interesting? Thus, Joseph was the son of both. And so he marries these two genealogies through this tradition that he reportedly gets from the family of the master, the Despicini. But the genealogical work here is not without its own difficulties as well, because it's missing some of the names that we have in any case. Here's the point. Here's what I would have you take away from that. There were problems because the genealogical records had been destroyed by Herod. That is a completely believable story, that we know Herod had issues like that. And we know, for example, his slaughter of the innocents. Why? Because he was threatened. He killed his own sons because he was afraid they would take his throne. So he knows that, number one, this story about Herod? He calls everyone in and he says to the Sanhedrin, what does it mean when it says that you shall only set a Jewish king over you? And they say, it means that you have to be a Jew. And so he says, for giving me such a bad answer, I'm going to have you all put to death. And he calls in the guards, and they come in and they kill the whole Sanhedrin. So this is Herod. And so the idea that Herod would have burned the genealogical records, which were kept in the temple, is completely plausible. So now, if that's the case, you can know that you're a Davidic family, but then try putting that together a generation later, saying, you know, we should really, what was the genealogy? Well, go ask Uncle Jude, you know. But then over here is Yossi saying, no, that's not it at all. It was, you know, and so it's very plausible that these genealogies are, you know, the apostles' best attempts but they're conflicting. So I don't have a problem, again, with conflicting genealogies. To me, this speaks more to the authenticity of our texts than it does to discredit them. That's about all I have to say about it, about the genealogies. Here's what Asher Norman concludes. He says, the flawed and contradictory genealogies in Luke and Matthew are extremely problematic, since genealogy is the only authentic messianic criteria that the Christian Bible claims that Jesus fulfilled. Jesus is eliminated from messianic consideration because of the myriad of errors and problems in both Matthew and Luke's genealogies. I disagree. Even if we had no genealogies at all, but only a strength of tradition, that would be sufficient. There is no one around today who has a verifiable genealogy who can take them all the way back to David. We'll never have a Messiah if a criteria is a foolproof, you know, verifiable genealogy. There's going to be no Messiah that can produce such a thing. However, there is this. Do you remember when the priests came back from Babylon, and some of them had lost their genealogical records? And then Ezra was asked, what should we do? Should we let them serve in the temple or not? Well, the problem is we don't know they're really priests. They don't have genealogies. And so Ezra decides, or was it Nehemiah? One of those guys. Ezra decides, we're not going to let them serve because we don't know. However, if a priest shows up with the Urim and the Thummim, so we can ask God directly, then we'll ask if they're legitimate priests, and that'll resolve the issue. So this is something that in Judaism is anticipated, that when Messiah comes, he will solve genealogical issues for everyone. So he'll be able to, you know, he'll go through the people of the Jewish people and say, you're a Simeonite, you're a Reubenite, because we have to have tribal identities in the Messianic era. So Messiah is, you know, going to sort these things out. By the same token, I think his own genealogy can be sorted out. You know, if you know, we can't have a Messianic era without all 12 tribal identities. Neither can we have a Messiah without a tribal identity from David. But the two things are related. Yes, I just think it's a fact of, I mean, we have messed up genealogies all through the Bible, contradicting genealogies in Chronicles and that don't match with this and that. I mean, it's not an unusual biblical problem to have. Genealogies are not, they're not a science in the Bible. All right, I think we're out of time, and we're probably not going to make it through the rest of this list then. What time is it? Yeah, we're out of time. The rest will go fast, and we can knock out the rest at the beginning of class next week, because the rest, it's just, he's right, he's right, he's right, he's right.